It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Later on, we'll be discussing the debate over giving sports teams Native American names.
But first, last week saw the worst violence in Egypt since the revolution began in 2011. The military-led government cracked down on Morsi supporters around the country, with death counts reported at 580 in a single day.
Today, a court has reportedly ordered the release of former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, who was ousted in 2011.
Here to give us an update on the situation in Egypt and discuss where the country might be headed is Saeed Khan, lecturer of Near East Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been reported that an Egyptian court has ordered that Hosni Mubarak might be released from prison. What's your take on what that might mean?
Well, what we see here is part of a larger agenda to revert Egypt back to a pre-2011 country, as if the Arab Spring had never happened. The Arab Spring was considered a monumental, even a paradigm shift, for the region in which, after a 30-year period of autocratic rule, Egypt, which is the cultural epicenter of the Arab world, had finally shaken off dictatorship, military rule which had been in the country since 1952, had done so in a peaceful way and in a process that only took 3 weeks. After the election of Mohamed Morsi last year, we saw that the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been outlawed for several decades in Egyptian political life, had won the election, an election which by all accounts was regarded to be open and transparent. And yet within 1 year, some opposition parties were forming, which then, with the military intervention of a few weeks ago, ousted Morsi, and as we saw culminating last week, have engaged in a purge to not only get rid of pro-democracy supporters, those who were advocating for a return of the legitimately elected prime minister, but also to, in a sense, purge the Muslim Brotherhood from political life all in one fell swoop.
Now, you said this is an effort to turn back the clock on the Arab Spring. The Egyptian military has been a big player in what's been happening recently. Where do they stand in all of this?
Well, the Egyptian military has seized the opportunity of a coalition of forces that were against the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi. It's important to understand that in many ways, Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood political party that he was leading represent the centrist position within Egyptian political life. On the one hand, to the left, were the liberal guard, the secularists, many of whom were wedded to both politically and economically to the Mubarak regime. And then on the right, you had a very strong and militant Salafi movement, which was much more fundamentalist. So the Muslim Brotherhood comes in and is trying to create some kind of middle ground in Egypt, at the same time having to deal with a rather foundering economy. 1 year was obviously not enough time to turn around what had taken several decades to ruin. And yet at the same time, because there was so much political acrimony, these opposition forces were able to gain a very vocal space within within Egypt, ironically taking the lessons that they had seen in Tahrir Square, which had ousted Mubarak in the first place. What really became a critical issue was when some of these opposition forces started calling for the military to intervene on their behalf. Those images are going to be unforgettable in showing the redirection of Egypt, that people in the streets of Cairo were welcoming the army helicopters overhead as they had signs dropped from the helicopter saying that we are with the people. With the reintroduction of the Egyptian military, it's akin to allowing the Trojan horse in, knowing full well that the Greek army is inside it. Now that they have regained their legitimacy as a rightful political actor within Egypt, we find that we are in the position that we see on the images today.
In terms of President Morsi and his ouster, he was one of the reasons that he was gotten rid of by the military was supposedly because he was not enough of a centrist and was shutting down moderate voices and a diversity of voices. How is the military moving forward with that notion now?
The military right now is doing not only what they accuse Morsi of doing, but doing so in a much more dramatic and an egregious way. There are campaigns now to completely extricate the Muslim Brotherhood from political life, while the military and with General Sisi pledging support for free and open elections early next year. There really is no decided plan that the Muslim Brotherhood are going to be allowed to stand for elections. There have been some symbolic gestures made, mostly for optics, to say that the Muslim Brotherhood has been invited to the proverbial table to negotiate with the military and with the interim regime to see if there is some space for it in future elections. The Muslim Brotherhood, though, as a matter of principle, has declined to participate in those, saying that to do so would then give legitimacy to the ouster of a prime minister who had been legitimately elected, and this would set a very dangerous precedent for the future of Egypt.
What role do you see the Gulf states playing in the situation going on in Egypt right now?
This is, I believe, one of the more underexplored and underreported facets of this story. First of all, it's very important to remember that both Saudi Arabia and Qatar, immediately upon the ouster of Morsi, pledged $12 billion to Egypt. And over the weekend, we hear several statements that have been made by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia that are calling for all able-bodied and minded Muslims to support the current regime and also to support the military. The outlawing of the Muslim Brotherhood serves the interests of the Gulf monarchies because they provide a much more legitimate counter-narrative to what has been professed as the stability of the autocratic monarchies. Here we find that there are Muslim political parties like the Muslim Brotherhood who have been playing within existing political systems of democracy and of elections. And the election of Morsi and of the Muslim Brotherhood last year was a watershed moment because it demonstrated that this was a model not unlike what one sees in Turkey with the election of AKP and Prime Minister Erdogan of a functional and a viable Muslim democratic system. This, of course, then bodes very poorly for the Gulf monarchies, and quite frankly, they would regard it as being an existential threat to the hold that they have on each of their respective countries.
Now, in terms of the possible release of Hosni Mubarak, what would that mean if that happened? What would be the future of a move like that?
Well, the release of Mubarak is going to be seen largely as a symbolic gesture. After all, he's in his mid-80s. He's not doing very well health-wise. What it may mean is, again, a return to the status quo ante, where one of the reasons why the Arab Spring happened in Egypt was this disillusionment among the people that another dynasty was going to be created in Egypt, that Mubarak was grooming his son, Gamal Mubarak, to then succeed him, and doing so in the guise of democracy. We have to remember that Mubarak always used to take pride in holding elections after outlawing many opposition groups, imprisoning many opposition leaders, and then conveniently winning with a 98.5% of the vote margin. So the fact that it seems as though the landscape is going to be set for not only Mubarak to be released, but for Mubarak's regime. I mean, after all, there were several hundred bureaucrats who were part of Mubarak's government, who also stand the prospect of coming back into the government, and more than that, also coming back into part of the larger economic profile of Egypt. A lot of the people who were positioned in different sectors of industry and who controlled different sectors of industry, including public utilities, were Mubarak people. So this notion of corruption and the reintroduction of corruption is an important element of this.
I've only got about a minute left, but what is your take on what the situation of the past week and the past month or so will mean for what seemed to be gained during the Arab Spring?
It's a rather bleak and a rather pessimistic development of events. The fact that the Arab Spring had ushered in not only change for some of these countries, Tunisia, Libya, and of course Egypt, but had augured a new spirit among the people that playing by the rules, going through with peaceful protest, would then usher in the kinds of results that they were seeking, bring about the political change that they were seeking, and also demonstrate to the world that they, like others, were seeking democracy and self-determination. The depth and the scope and the scale of the rebuke that they have received of going through and playing by the rules then runs the risk of radicalization, those people who will feel that there is not really any opportunity or any point in playing by the rules and going through these political systems. And one has to dread whether democracy, although not dead in the region, may be in a vegetative state.
Well, Saeed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We were talking with Saeed Khan, lecturer of Near East Studies at Wayne State University.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll hear about the debate over giving sports teams Native American names. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later on, we'll be talking about sinkholes, what they are, how they form, and what to look out for. It's coming up in about 30 minutes.
First, though, we return to the topic of Native American team names and imagery in sports. Recently, the online publication Slate joined a growing number of news outlets that said they'll stop referring to the Washington football team as the Redskins.
Slate editor David Plotz says the term is extremely tacky and dated, and now other publications are following in his footsteps. Nothing might come from the boycott, but it is raising the issue of why we keep on using potentially offensive Native American nicknames for sports teams.
Joining us now is Richard King. He is a professor of comparative ethnic studies at Washington State University and co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Native Americans in Sports. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Well, first off, what's your reaction to the decision by Slate and other publications to stop using the name Redskins?
I think it's a positive move. I think it represents, I would say, probably the beginnings of the end of the team name, or at least I hope that that's the case. But I would note that, you know, it was probably 20 years ago that newspapers like the Oregonian and the newspaper in Minneapolis, the Star Tribune, stopped using certain references, only later to again use some team names that are offensive. So I'd say it's a good sign. I hope it's a lasting sign, but I'm a realist.
Mm-hmm. Well, the team's owner has said that he will never, I guess, in all caps, change the team's name. So I wonder what will come next from this move.
Well, I think the most important thing about the move is that it encourages further dialogue about the origin of the team name, what that reference actually means, and what the state of race relations and racism is in the contemporary U.S. I think that one of the difficulties around talking about mascots, even when a team has a name as offensive as the Washington football team does, is that people take the names for granted and people accept them as a normal, natural part of everyday life. And this is a good sort of move just to interrupt that normalcy and to prompt people to hopefully think a little bit more about issues that they don't think about.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history behind the name Redskin? And I'm wondering, when these teams were established, for example, what was a social or political climate of the time that made it a bit more acceptable than we might think it is today?
Sure. The team name, the team that's now in Washington, started in Boston, and they originally were called the Boston Braves. And then soon after their establishment, I think the second or third year of their existence, they changed their name to Redskins to differentiate themselves from the local baseball team, which was also called the Boston Braves. Mm-hmm. And the owner at the time said to pay honor to their coach, who claimed to be Native American at the time, when in fact he was not Native American. And the selection of a team name that had a Native American reference in the 30s would have been a pretty normal and very acceptable kind of practice. And people would not have really batted an eye at it. I think that many people in the first half of the 20th century felt that part of what indigenous people represented were some of the qualities that they also wanted their sports teams to represent. In terms of particular ideals of masculinity, physical prowess, bravery, traits like that.
Now, Richard, I can remember about 10, 15 years ago, there was a big move to change names like this to get them out off the public eye and rename these teams. And lots of towns, even small towns in Wisconsin, were re-choosing names. And it seems as though somewhere along the way that movement got stalled. It became kind of a halfway revolution or consciousness raising. Do you know what happened?
Well, this is actually, if we take right now as a movement or a critical moment, I would say that this is probably the third critical push that's happened. The first was in the late 60s and early 70s when teams at universities like Stanford and Dartmouth, University of Oklahoma, changed their team names. And then as the American Indian movement and Red Power more generally kind of faded out, that first push fell away. And then in the late 80s and early 90s, there was another push that really drew a lot of attention to the issue. And I think that certain changes were made, again, at some universities and in some states, in which local school boards either encourage study or encourage change. And again, that I think that pushed the issue forward, but most people did not still at that moment see a problem. And now, again, 20 years later, I think the issue is being has sort of been re-energized, in part because of ongoing litigation against the Washington football team, and in part because educators have, I think, really understood some of the lasting psychological and social impacts of such names and imagery.
Why does there seem to be, I guess, a gray area for people that when there is no question in some other cases that racial slurs are inappropriate or not collectively acceptable anymore, but yet there's a lot of debate still surrounding Native American culture. Why is that?
Well, I think that there are a number of reasons. One important reason is, I think, the small number of Native Americans that are in the United States. I think that demographic presence or limited demographic presence really mutes their voices in a way that if they were if there were 10 times as many Native Americans would be a different kind of situation. I think that also Native Americans tend not to be in major media markets like DC in great numbers, and so the teams can get away with it. Now, more broadly, I think that most Americans don't think of positive stereotyping as problematic, right? They look at the images and say, that's positive. I'm doing something good. I'm saying something that's positive about those people, right? And as long as that positivity is not questioned or seen for the impacts it has or has, then people, I think, are less likely to make the change. And finally, I think there's a really important kind of historical difference between how we think about racism in the U.S. I mean, we tend to think about racism in black and white terms, and that really shapes the language as well as the struggle that is involved. As for why the N-word is problematic and the R-word is acceptable. I think that goes really directly to Americans' feelings and experiences with race and feelings and experiences with indigenous people.
Mm. We're talking with Richard King, a professor at Washington State University and co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Native Americans and Sports.
And we'd love to know what you think about this. How do you feel about the use of Native American names and imagery in sports? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can let us know what you're thinking on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll start taking your calls right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Richard King, a professor at Washington State University and co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Native Americans in Sports. And we want to know what you think. How do you feel about the use of Native American names and imagery in sports? As we learn that Slate.com will no longer use the term Redskins when it's writing about football. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Richard, one thing that's curious is that the Redskins seem to be singled out right now for the movement of Slate.com. At least that's what Slate has written about. What about all the other teams that use Native American names and are pretty high profile? I mean, look at the Cleveland Indians, for instance. And if you look up their mascot, which we posted on the Central Time Facebook page, I mean, it's clearly a caricature that would be offensive to people. Why are we only looking at Washington?
Well, I think that you raise a really good issue that is really one of the dangers of focusing the energy on the Washington football team. I think that people are focusing on Washington because it's so clearly a case in which a slur is being repeated and is deemed acceptable. And I think it's easy to focus energy on that because of the R word. Should be gone, just like the N-word should be gone. And that kind of equivalence makes the push, I think, perhaps a little bit easier. It's also perhaps the case that it has a bit more of a profile than the Cleveland baseball team. But I think that you're very correct to, one, draw attention to the numerous other teams that are problematic, and, two, to sort of underscore the fact that most of them get a pass, both in the media and the public. I mean, no one, except for a few people that I'm colleagues with, had a lot to say during the most recent Stanley Cup, for example, about the Chicago team and fan antics that are associated with that, and a variety of other things that we could delve into related to them.
Well, let's take a call first from Clifton in Green Bay. Hi, Clifton.
Hi, my name is Clinton.
Clinton, sorry.
Yeah, I'm an enrolled member out of Lac-Tofambo Anishinaabe, and a student at University of Wisconsin Green Bay. And I recently, over the years, have been learning more and more about the mascot issue. And growing up in Wisconsin, I've seen many different high schools and different things like that, and a lot of non-native students wearing different mascot images, like from different teams around the state, calling them Chiefs or Savages or whatever it is. But I grew up liking the image too of like Chicago Blackhawks and Cleveland Indians, and would wear these hats, you know, thinking that, I don't know, like finding some sort of pride into wearing these different images. And it wasn't until recently, really looking at the different perspectives and the studies that went into how these mascots really have impact on the younger generation of Native Americans, I found that, you know, it wasn't acceptable for me to represent myself in that way. And I really wanted to like promote to this institute that I went to over the summer. It was through the Department of Instruction out of Wisconsin, called the American Indian Studies Institute, where there were a lot of Native and non-Natives that we really delved into a lot of these issues. And it wasn't until after that institute that I looked at this Blackhawks hat that I've worn for a long time and just threw it in the trash and said, you know, hey, like this, you know, this is not how my people should be represented. This is not the right way. And I just really wanted to share coming from that perspective and that.
Yeah, I'm really glad.
Important work.
Really glad that you called, Clinton. I want to ask you, though, how did you see this affecting younger generations of Native Americans? You said that was sort of your wake-up call. What did you see happening?
Yeah, well, there was a... I'm not sure who the author was of this study, but there was a woman who did a study and looked at how it affected younger generations' self-esteem. And so that had an impact. There was a study that shown that there was an impact on the younger generation of Native American kids, but in particular, the Summer Institute that I went to, I seen the impact that it had on non-Natives. I'm talking about educators. There were educators there, a lot of different ages of non-Native participants at this institute, and they were just really unaware. They were unaware about the modern Native American, what the current status of Native Americans were. And the image that was in their mind was this image that, you know, like you see on mascots, like you see for the Cleveland Indians or Chicago Blackhawks, that we still live in teepees, that I wasn't upset, but it was more of like, you know, needs to be more awareness, and there needs to be some sort of the mascot thing needs to go for sure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Clinton. What do you think, Richard?
I think this is a really important phone call on a number of levels. First, the research, I believe that the gentleman is speaking of, was done by Stephanie Freiberg, who's a psychologist at the University of Arizona, that has shown that images like mascots do have a negative impact on American and Indian youth's sense of themselves and their communities, prospects for the future, and are generally have a negative impact. So I think that it's really important that get communicated and that more people recognize that this isn't just a situation in which people feel offended or think something is ugly, right? That these are actual impacts that can be identified. And I think that that's very significant, particularly in educational institutions that are supposed to be doing something quite the opposite. I think the second point that's really crucial to underscore from this call is that most Americans misrecognize Native Americans because they have misrepresentations of them. And mascots contribute to a kind of dehumanization of Native Americans where people can't or don't see indigenous people as their next-door neighbors, as people that live in the present, as people that have hopes and dreams and feelings. And I think that education can lead to empathy, and together they can encourage a creation of alternatives.
Richard, I know you've been researching this for a while, and we just heard Clinton's experience, his personal experience, and how he kind of came to a change of heart on this issue. In your experience, what does it take to really change someone's mind and to see what you see in this issue?
Well, I think that I would say that what it takes is for people to be open to other perspectives. It takes people being empathetic to the experiences and the ideas of indigenous people. It takes really, I think, a teasing out of the history and the social nature of these images, that they're not natural facts, that they don't do what people think that they do. I think that those are some of the ways that or pathways to change. I mean, one of the real dangers, maybe that might be a bit of a strong word, but one of the real dangers of legislating change on these issues, I mean, it does make for change, but it doesn't foster a deeper understanding. It doesn't foster any kind of reflection. And that's, I think, where the hope is at, right? Because what it really does, if a state like Wisconsin or Oregon recently says schools should get rid of the mascots, is it causes a great deal of pushback. And the pushback becomes not about indigenous people. It doesn't become about what the imagery says or is doing. It becomes about the people who have the mascot, right? And so they have the mascot. It's our Indian, right? It's our tradition. You can't tell us what to do with it. And that's not a very productive place for a lot of these conversations to begin. And I think if I were to try to read Dan Snyder's mind, I think that part of why he says the name will never change, and you can put that in all caps, is because the symbol is meaningful to him. He doesn't see it as others see it, and he's pushing back in a very base fashion.
Okay, let's go see if we can get in one more call. We're running pretty short of time here, but one quick call and answer. We've got Dan next in Osseo. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I think my question is related exactly to what your guest just spoke about, how divisive it is to a community to have to deal with that, and actually not have to deal with it, but try to deal with it, and even having the conversation, but then it just takes the community and rips it apart and splits it right down the middle. And as you said, it becomes a we've got it, we're not going to give it up, that's how we identify ourselves argument.
All right.
I really did that in our community.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dan. And Richard, we've got about a minute left.
No, I think that the one thing that doesn't get talked about enough with mascots is, yes, these are representations of indigenous people, and we need to listen to what indigenous people are saying about them and be mindful about that. But we also need to, I think, raise the issue of whiteness, of white identity, and of white racism, and encourage people to reflect on those issues as well. Why is it that communities feel entitled to create these kinds of images? How does it connect to the historic treatment and settlement of the continent, and a variety of other things that we so rarely talk about around these issues?
All right. Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Richard King is a professor of comparative ethnic studies at Washington State University and co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Native Americans in Sports.
Coming up next, we'll take a closer look at what sinkholes are, how they form, and what to watch out for. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Sinkholes have been in the news lately, the most recent example being one in Florida that swallowed part of a resort last week. And there's been some dramatic images and videos of the aftermath, but we wanted to know why these sinkholes form in the first place and why it seems like they're happening more frequently these days. Joining us now in the studio is Dave Hart, a hydrogeologist at Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, part of the UW Extension. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cynthia.
So what exactly is a sinkhole?
Well, I think it's a pretty aptly named geologic feature. What it is it's a hole in the ground where the earth or sediment has sunk down into the ground. So there was a void in the carbonate rock generally beneath and in the ground, and then you had some rainwater or wash the soil down into the void and leaving a hole behind.
I can't even fathom this, but I know that it's happened, and I think I recall it happened in Milwaukee not too long ago.
Right. Well, I should also say there's a couple types of sinkholes. One I would term really kind of a cultural sinkhole, and the other would be more of the natural or geologic. In many cities, you have aging infrastructure, and what happens there is a water main breaks, or you have a break in a sewer line. And the sewer line then forms the void, and the water main moves the sediment, and then you wash out all the sediment, and then you get a collapse there as well, too. I think then you have a vehicle or something fall into it. Mm-hmm. And since most of the infrastructure is under the streets, you typically see a vehicle fall into those large sinkholes. So, and that would be what we'd call a cultural sinkhole, as opposed to the Florida sinkholes were geologic, where the rock had been dissolved away beneath the ground, and then water had kind of caused the overlying sediment to move in, and then everything collapsed.
Wow. So in what ways does human activity contribute to them, if at all?
Sure, sure. So the cultural one is obvious, but the, you know, that's a lack of taking care of infrastructure, perhaps. The geologic, sometimes, you know, you need two things for a sinkhole. One is you need that void in the rock underneath the ground, and the other is you need water. And so what we do on the surface, moving the water around, can often cause sinkholes to form where one hadn't been likely to form before. When we change the way the water drains on the surface, for example, that can cause one. I've seen sinkholes form underneath retention ponds where we've removed a lot of the overlying soil. You get a lot of water sitting on top of a thinner sediment, and then that it's much more easy for the sinkhole to form then. And in that instance, the retention pond drained completely. One resident tells me there was actually a whirlpool in this pond, and this was in on the west side of Madison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what are the warning signs, if any, that there's a sinkhole forming?
Well, we can break the geologic sinkholes into two types. One would be a cover subsidence, in which the sinkhole gradually forms, the sediment slowly moving down into, and you just see a shallow depression in your yard, and it won't go away. You can put dirt on top of it, and it comes back. Mm-hmm. The other type would be the cover collapse, and that's the one that really kind of alarms people. You really don't get a warning that you would have a cover collapse sinkhole. It just shows up one morning, and it's what happens there is the soil up above is stiff enough, it kind of acts like a bridge and the water moves the soil beneath, and it just kind of eats its way from down below up to the surface and then finally collapses when the soil can't hold itself up anymore.
Is there a way to prevent them?
What I generally tell people is if you're in a place where there's carbonate rock in Wisconsin, and that kind of extends from the Green Bay area down through Madison, then back up to St. Croix in a big U shape. If you're in a place like that, the only thing you can do is control how the water moves. So move the water away from your house. If you have a sinkhole that formed at one time, fill it in and kind of keep the water away from it, and that'll go a long way. You know, water and the void, those two things, you can control the water usually.
Are there, I don't know, people like yourself that are studying this, actively looking at how the water flows and kind of monitoring the landscape for that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would say a more active area of research is really what happens after the water goes into the sinkhole. And there's a lot of concern, you know, when we see a sinkhole in Wisconsin, we're really more concerned about groundwater. They generally don't cause, aren't a health hazard or a risk hazard. But when we see a sinkhole in Wisconsin, we're much more concerned that we've opened up a contaminant pathway to our groundwater system. It's a direct mm-hmm. pathway. You know, we've got those cracks in the rock that the soil's gone into. And that just indicates to us that there are other cracks. So if you see one sinkhole, we know the whole underlying rock formation is cracked and has conduits. And so then when we see a sinkhole, we know there might be an issue with a groundwater contamination or possibility. And so we're concerned about what happens on the land surface then.
So on account of Wisconsin's geology, is there an average size of a sinkhole? Are they generally small, large, or do they vary?
Yeah, I think in terms of if you look at overall sinkholes, ours are on the small side. Florida has, you know, I think the one that where the house collapsed into recently was maybe 50 feet across, and those are fairly common in Florida, mm-hmm. not Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, the typical sinkhole is maybe 5 to 10 feet across, and that's about as big as they get. I've seen a few a bit larger, but they are the exception. And that has to do with the difference in the rocks, the difference in the geology in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's carbonate rocks are made of mineral called dolomite, which does not dissolve nearly as easily as the calcite that you would see in the limestones of Florida. So, and that, since our rocks don't dissolve as easily, we don't get as big a conduits, we don't get as big a cracks, it's not as dissolved, and so you don't have those voids down below the ground that can really cause this collapse. We have a few caves, Cave of the Mounds, the caves out at Ledgeview, you know, and other places where, but in general, we don't have huge voids underneath our feet. More, we have little cracks and conduits.
How deep are they?
The cracks and conduits?
Yeah. If the sinkholes are 5 to 7 feet across, I believe
the actual hole is maybe, it's about as deep as it is wide usually. Very often, but underneath that sinkhole is where all the cracks and conduits are. Usually you'll see that when the sinkhole collapses, you can see some sediment and maybe some broken up rock in the bottom of the hole. But, and more than likely, there's not a big cave underneath there. People are always concerned that there's a big cave. More than likely, it's just a network of cracks. And maybe some smaller conduits. And people have seen these when they drive down the highway. My favorite place to kind of imagine where sinkholes would form would be on the drive from Madison to Dubuque on Highway 151. If you look, you can see the dolomite rock outcrops as you drive down the highway where the Department of Transportation has removed rock. You can see all the cracks. You can see where the soil's gone in some of those instances. You can also see as you go to the escarpment as well, too. So,
have you found any fraggles down there?
No, I have gone in a few caves. I've not seen any. I've seen some cave critters, but no fraggles.
No fraggles. Okay. No. Well, how worried should we be about sinkholes?
I think in terms of falling in a sinkhole, I think there's one instance of someone in Wisconsin actually falling in a sinkhole. The gentleman recovered fine. A neighbor got him out. I'm sure it was a very disturbing experience. But that's the only instance there, and there was no long-term injury there. So I'm in general not too worried about injury with sinkholes or even property damage. You can take care of them. You can fill them up. I'm much more concerned about our groundwater and what might happen if we leave a sinkhole and we can get contaminants in there into our groundwater system.
Well, what got you, we only have a minute left.
Yeah.
What got you interested
sure.
in, you know?
How did I get interested in sinkholes? Well, one of the things I do at the Geological Survey is I do some near surface geophysics. So I do things like ground penetrating radar and resistivity. And we use that to see if we could find those conduits and those rocks and voids and cracks. So I just thought they're a neat feature to look at. I've had a great time looking at them ever since.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for telling us about them.
Sure.
That was Dave Hart. He's a hydrogeologist at the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey.
Coming up next, we'll learn how dancing in the street became the anthem for a changing America. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.